15 years, there was no guarantee of building about 75 years for most of them. And most of them started to fall apart, obviously, so whether it was inside of those tanks, there's all sorts of chemicals. Vapors from there are leaking, even our office buildings in the study can smell them. So we've got to get those taken care of, that should be priority number one for all the Hanford workers. Their safety, so I'm saying that the reactor, the end reactor was, the way that you came to work today, walking upright with all your fingers and all your toes, that's the way you're supposed to go home, and that's what we should be striving for at the Hanford site. Safety first, not monetary gain for the companies in form of stipends for doing work and providing goals or stretch goals. The other issue that I've been working on has to deal with a pressing issue called removing the name of branch campus from our campuses, Now, you would think that that would be a no-brainer, but it's taken 3 years to get the bill through. And finally, WSU, University of Washington, sat down and said, well, that's a good idea, these campuses are getting big enough that they don't need to really have the word branch on them. And so they're now going to become somewhat independent organizations, but they're still going to be tied into what I call the mothership, or motherships, University of Washington or WSU Palm. So I've been working on several other bills, but I'm going to let Brad talk about that. But again, you have a lot of good ideas, and I appreciate all the ideas that you forwarded to me. Please keep doing that, and so we can do legislative reform.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My soldiers have saved this town one more time. Good morning.
Good morning.
Very good. So anyway, the number one reason we came here today is more to hear from you than for you to hear from us. And so let me just very quickly say, I am a ranking member on the Public Safety Committee. So in each committee, you have a chair. The chair represents the majority party, and then you have a ranking member, and that ranking member represents the minority. So in the House, Democrats have 50 members, and Republicans have 48, so we're the minority. And so I'm the leading person in public safety for the minority caucus. I also sit on the Judiciary Committee. I've sat on both those committees now for 8 years, and then this year I was assigned to early learning and human resources, I think, I'm not sure. ADOL, human services. Yesterday, after that committee meeting, and she's not chair. We had, after our committee meeting for hours, we had a rally at Olympia out in front of the legislative building for foster parents and foster children. Really cool thing, foster parents from all over the state came with foster children, so that was a very neat time. I wrestled against becoming a member of that committee because I came off of public safety and transportation committee, education committee, to put on that committee, and I'd rather stay here. I said I'd rather stay on transportation and education. They said, no, we won't be there. And I said, okay, keep flagging and wait orders, and that's what I did. And it has been a much more rewarding experience than I expected. I've been really able to offer a lot of good conversations on early learning and human services. And so anyway, with that, any further ado, I'm going to pass this microphone to Patrick McPurdy. Patrick's going to be our moderator. Patrick's going to set the ground rules, and Patrick's going to say what goes. So ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, please welcome our moderator, Patrick McPurdy.
Well, my role this morning was really just to be sort of a traffic cop, basically, this light's green, that light's red. This is Kenzie Davidson. She is the daughter of our new state treasurer, Dwayne Davidson, and I'm glad to have her assisting me this morning. She'll be keeping time for us. So there are a lot of people here. In order to facilitate a conversation, we're going to ask you limit your statements and questions to about 2 minutes, and then please indicate which representative or either representative that you want to address your concern. And I think that if we, what would be your place to be on the line? Why don't we just have you come right up here to the center? And those of you who want to ask questions, why don't you come right up here to the beginning? We'll give you comply with Washington State privacy laws. This is being recorded.
So just before we get started, I failed to say thank you to Larry Winters and his assistant Jan.
So I see a line forming. Why don't you come on up and state your name?
My question and concern are for both of you. Last night I appeared on the 2020 episode as an undercover mom at a conversion therapy boot camp. Washington State is one state in our United States that does not sponsor opposition to conversion therapy. We've not talked about it. Equality for all is everyone. It should be unlawful and criminal for parents to send their children away to virtually a boot camp, prison boot camp. The kids I saw worked 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. They did all their cooking, all their own cleaning. They were forbidden to contact home. And correspondence coming in and out of that camp was monitored and had to meet with the headmaster's approval. Beatings are part of their program. This should not be happening in our country in 2017. I strongly oppose, additionally, the trans bathroom law. Make no mistake, when a transgender person enters the bathroom, they are immediately at risk. They are not the violators. I respectfully request that you hear all your constituents, even those of us on the blue side of your state.
For those of you who have not read the bill, Clint's gonna make a copy of the bill available to you. Raise your hand if you'd like a copy of the bill. I strongly encourage you to take a copy of the bill right now. Actually, that's the bill report. Let's start with the bill. I apologize, I missed my hand. That's the bill. Then we're gonna hand out the bill report. You're gonna see exactly what happens in Washington State with, in the legislature with the bill. While you're passing those out, this first is the bill. Fred's handing out. Dan's handing out the bill report. I want you to know when I make my comments, in no way, shape, or form am I trying to pit myself against Representative Hayter. Representative Hayter voted yes for this bill. He tried to sponsor it. I voted no, and I'm going to show you exactly why I voted no. Okay, so at the end, you'll know exactly why I voted no. So my comments have nothing to do with my respect and my appreciation for Representative Hayter and his work. You need to know when I make my comments, nothing is meant to be in opposition to Representative Hayter, my seatmate, who I love and respect as a comrade. Okay? Okay, so now, Mr. Dolby, would you have a cap? This is now my personal notes of the bill and why I voted against the bill for you to look at. As book the bill report in the bill. And we basically you guys get those so you'll be able to go through with them step by step. Also, other, they're passing those up. Representative Hayter worked out of Hanford as a nuclear operator and a trainer. Anything else there? Okay, so extensive experience as a nuclear operator and many facets of the operations at Hanford. I worked as a mill line at Hanford, 100N, it was an operating nuclear reactor producing electricity, worked charge, discharge, and that's one of the ways I helped put myself through college. I also worked construction on the only operating nuclear reactor we have right now at Energy Northwest, Columbia Generating Station. So now I still patrol out there as a law enforcement officer for the Fenton County Sheriff's Office. We have legal authority to enforce the traffic crimes and the laws of Washington in the United States out of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. So I've worked out there since 1978, I think, or before. So, not quite the extensive experience Larry has, but I have worked at the both the nuclear reactor and the construction office. When everyone's got one, let me know. You ready to go?
Yes.
All right, let's go. Let's go first of all to the back page of the bill report on page 4. Back page of the bill report, page 4. You go. What we get when there is a hearing in Olympia, everyone who wants to in the state of Washington, I strongly encourage you from this day forward, if there's something that's important to you, come to Olympia and sign in, willing to testify. And you can either testify in support of a bill or in opposition of a bill. So then they give us a brief summary, because I am not on that committee. This bill would be for the Appropriations Committee and one of the I got to remember
Labor.
So I don't sit on either one of those, so I have to trust what I hear in bill reports and from my fellow legislators. So if you move to opposition, opposition on page 4 says opposed. And this is what, just a few notes of what the people who are opposed to this bill said. The legislature is the steward of the workers' compensation program. It needs to be balanced, fair, and the most important word I want you to hear here is sustainable. Balanced, fair, and sustainable. It goes on. The occupational disease presumption, the bill is breathtaking in its scope and inclusivity. And the last sentence says, establishing a presumption creates a bad precedent. Okay, so let's leave that. In the bill, I want to let you know, it left the House floor 69 yes, 29 no. Now let's go to the exact, to the bill itself. I gave you a naked form of the bill, which you can see without any marks whatsoever. And then I gave you a copy of the bill with my marks and my notes on as I read the bill word for word. Let's go to the definition of the bill, or actually the bill title. The bill title is the top on line 1, 2, and 3 on page 1. It says, an act related to the presumption of occupational disease for what? Certain employees. Okay? Certain employees. That kind of
I put that in the ballot, so is it fair? Is it for everyone? Because it says certain employees. Let's go to the next, let's go down to line 9, actually 10 and 11, where it talks about Hanford Nuclear Site. It defines the Hanford Nuclear Site as 560 square miles in southeastern Washington. 560 miles in southeastern Washington. Now I live on 2.9 acres in Kennewick. How defensible do you think that would be if I had a description of my property of 2.9 acres in southern Kennewick? How would anybody know where that is? Keep going. You want to tell me what it says? Does it give a lat long? Does it give the corners? Does it give specific of where that 560 square miles is? So that's one issue I had at the first point. Where's this 560 square miles? 560 square miles in southeastern Washington. So we're very, very broad. Okay? Let's keep going. Let's go down to line 50. It says, a site worker is any person, including a contractor or subcontractor, who was engaged in the performance of work directly or indirectly. How many people think that this bill is specifically supposed to address those things associated with the tanks? Okay? Nobody thought that? That's what I'm hoping to know and address. Exactly what Representative Hayter said. Protect those people who are working with the tanks on the tank line, because that's where you have a real problem. But it doesn't even address that. Any worker who could be a contractor, subcontractor, who's directly or indirectly involved in work on the 560 square miles in southeastern Washington. Keep going. Regarding projects, contracts at the Hanford Nuclear Site who worked on the site for at least one eight-hour shift. If you worked on the Hanford Nuclear Site, 1 8-hour shift at any time in your lifetime, you now qualify for this bill. 1 8-hour shift in your lifetime, you now qualify for presumptive coverage under this bill. Okay? We'll keep going. Let's go to the next page. That means anyone who has ever worked on that site is covered under this bill, but I'll just let this stop right there. Keep going. And just tell me why I voted no. I'm not trying to tear this bill up, I'm just telling you why I voted no. We're on the next page. We're now on page 2. We're on line 1. It says, there exists a prima facie presumption. A presumption is, it's presumed. If you catch any of the diseases listening to the bill, and you work 8 hours, 1 8-hour shift in that 560 square mile area in southeast Washington, it's presumed whatever you caught, if it's listed in here, you got it because you worked at least an 8-hour shift. So that's a whole lot of people, ladies and gentlemen. That's hundreds of thousands of people who are covered, right? We keep going. Diseases and conditions listed are occupational diseases under RCW. Okay, so we move on down. We're now on line 10, respiratory disease. Does it define what kind of respiratory disease? No, it's totally, completely unlimited. Any respiratory disease whatsoever, you work an 8-hour shift in your lifetime, and that 5 or 6 square miles, it's covered. Let's go 3B, any heart problem experienced within 3 days, 72 hours, from 72 hours of exposure to fumes, toxic substances, or chemicals to the site. Does it define what kind of fumes? No. If I went under the counter and smelled bleach, I'm covered, because it's a fume. It doesn't say what kind of fume. That's why you've got to be specific in the law. You got to say what you're actually covering. So any fume, toxic substance, bleach is a toxic substance. If I go underneath the sink to get some bleach, put in some water to clean the counter, I'm now exposed to a toxic substance in a fume. Okay? And then it goes for chemicals on the site. How many chemicals do we have on that 560 square miles in southeastern Washington? A whole boatload of them. But it doesn't define what kind of chemicals they are. So exposure to any chemical, any fume on the site, you're not presumptive covered. Okay? It talks about cancer. Okay? Cancer is the one it gets most specific about. It goes about 3 to 4 paragraphs in the descriptions, and you can read through there. I'm not going to bore you with the details. And it gets more specific on cancer. And it also does a very good job on cancer. So you have to have had a physical examination, prior to going to work on the site, showing that you have pre-existing cancerous disease. That's good. I like that a lot. But there's 4 paragraphs of cancer that would be covered. Okay? Let's go down to line 15 where it talks about neurological diseases. Neurological diseases. Does it define neurological diseases. No. So any neurological disease whatsoever you get, if you work an 8-hour shift in that 564 miles in southeastern Washington, you're covered. My wonderful brother, who I love very much, is in the back of the room. Our father died of a neurological disease. If I remember correctly, that's what the doctor put on the death certificate. He worked at 100 years for decades, at 100 End, where I worked at, and at a particular project for decades. So now we're going to get on the bill later that will show you that my daughter, my father is covered, and my brother and I can sue for the hamper. So I'm covered, because I worked out there. My father's covered, and we'll keep going. So it doesn't say which neurological disease. It opens it wide open. Okay? So we go down. Okay? Line 4. Presumption established for cancer only applies. Oh, I already told you about that. So we don't need to do that. So line 2. The next few paragraphs talks about all the forms of cancer. Now let's go to page 3. Line 9. Okay? We're on section 5. Paragraph 5A. The presumption established in this section extends to an applicable United States Department of Energy hamper site worker for the lifetime of the individual. Okay? So if I get a job out there and I say I go to work, maybe I get my college degree, but I didn't before I went to work out there. So I go to work there at age 18. I can retire at 38. So I retire at 38, and now at age 88, I can't put any of these diseases. 30 years later, 40 years later, 30 years later, I'm covered. Because it's any time in my lifetime. It's presumed that if I catch one of these diseases, even if I haven't been out on that site for 30 years, I'm covered. It's presumed I got it because I worked out there an 8-hour shift. Okay? So the lifetime of that individual. Letter B. The worker or survivor, that's me and my brother, who has died as a result of one of the conditions or diseases listed, whose claim was denied on appeal or a court, can file a new claim for the same exposure, condition, or disease. So if this bill passes, then my brother and I can sue the federal government or the state of Washington because my father died of a neurological disease and he worked out at Hampton site. Okay? And then, letter C says, this section applies to decisions made after the effective date of this section without regard to the date of the last injurious exposure or the claim of the filing. So it's from the first time we started, way back in 1940-whatever, when we moved out there from the Manhattan Project, to date. All that time in between is covered by this bill. That is the reason, hopefully that explains to you why I voted no. If it was more definite, if we define what is that 564 miles, where does it end, where does it start, okay? If I had to be directly involved, because it doesn't have to be direct, I could just do indirectly. If I just drove my car through there for 8 hours on patrol as a hamper patrolman, never got out of my car, then you want me to explain or not? You're tapping your wrist.
Yes, we're all asked to be on time. I really appreciate your effort to write things down.
That's my reason. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
One thing that I wanted to say is that
there
is
going
to be
I had a friend who worked at the 100 End area, and I'll beg to differ with you to flip it on every point here. He died of liver cancer because he smelled hydrazine fumes. We were using hydrazine out there for the rods. After his death, they stopped using hydrazine. So, and it went to a chlorine substance. I appreciate Mr. Clifford's point of view, but when I went through the education process that all of us legislators go through in order to write bills, which took a week, 2 weeks actually, we were told you never write a bill so tight that it tells you exactly pinpoint the area. Our laws are written such that they will never give you the coordinates, the time, and the date. They are written in a very generic form, and you cannot say that it happens strictly at the tank farms, because I know people who have died working at the reactors either due to cancer or to injuries. So I, in defense of this bill, this is for the Hanford workers, this is, as well as those who are being poisoned today by the Department of Energy.
Okay, next contestant.
Hello, my name is Chidam Chauhan. I'm a Richmond resident. I've been here for 7 years. I have a question for both representatives. And I would like to know where you stand on the Clean Energy Transition Act. Also, would you think that the carbon tax bill that has been introduced in the House?
That's one of those bills that has morphed and become a many splendid thing. One day it's we're gonna fund education with it. The next day it changes. So I think we're gonna have a carbon tax. We need to settle down on where the money's actually gonna go to. Do we actually need a carbon tax? Because basically, if you take a look at this state, we produce 0.003% of the carbon from our industries within this state, and it goes three more zeros after that on a national or worldwide basis. Most of our power comes from hydro, 80%, 15% from nuclear. I think we're going to be looking at a carbon tax. It should be strictly something that we know if it does go through, we know where the monies are going to go, and it should go into education. It shouldn't go into any of our pet projects in the legislature. So that's one thing that I'd like to say to you is a carbon tax. It should go into education. But that hasn't been the proposal so far. Thank you. I really appreciate your point of view.
So can you tell me about the Clean Energy Act that you're asking about?
That's right.
And so HB what part of it? It's a huge act. So what part of it would you like most to use?
So what interests me is that all the incentive it gives to reduce carbon emissions and making pay the polluters, consumers, and invest potentially that money into energy efficiency. Hopefully, maybe we can find public transportation. It will be up to the different factors to propose, come up with proposals.
So specifically, you want to know how I feel about the Clean Energy Act in terms of fines and
in terms of our way to transition into a clean economy. Because right now it's climate inaction and this is not
sustainable. Is that it? Okay, so here's that's your time then. Hold on 2 minutes time. When you shut up, now my time's up.
I'll take you down on the
screen. I mean, think that we had just way too warm of a winter this year in the Tri-Cities.
You may not like what Representative Conner has to say, but you need to give it at least the 2 minutes to respond.
He's got to speak truth. Yeah. Yeah.
Can he ask for a response?
Okay, so you want me to address the question?
Yes, please.
You shout out again while I'm talking, I'll just stop talking.
Great.
Okay. So we've had one of the coldest, snowiest winters on record, okay? Last year, we had a great snowpack in the Cascade Mountains, and we had plenty of water. The year before, we didn't have so much, a little bit less, okay? Washington State represents 3/10 of 1% of the carbon emissions going into the Earth's atmosphere. Okay? So my answer to your question is, right now, I don't think we have a global warming problem, but I'm willing to invest taxes on businesses or citizens to fix. So I think that we had one of the greatest grape crops we've had in Washington State history. Our crops are telling us that our climate is just fine. We have made Eastern Washington know how to put carbon. We do it by planting crops which eat carbon and put out oxygen. And I don't want to do anything in terms of charging taxes or fines on businesses or people who would make our winter next year even colder and snowier than this year. So that's my response.
Thank you.
Your name, sir?
Brett Evans, parent of a young man with a developmental disability, also a member of the board of directors of our Tri-Cities. Change the subject a little bit. We recognize that the national legislature and the executive branch are planning to overhaul the Affordable Care Act, maybe overhaul it too polite in a way to put it. And in the middle of that, a reform is being put Medicare and how Medicare is funded. My presumption, maybe hopefully is a bad one, is that there's very little that the opposing party can do to stop that going forward, and that by this time next year, we will be looking at our state having to deal, and all the states, having to deal with the fallout of pushing the Medicare problem and how to fund continuing services, medical services, coupons, if it's pushed into just block grants that then start to expire over time. How are we starting to think about how we're going to deal with that, given that we have a growing population of people with developmental disabilities, even today, who are not receiving adequate service? Fortunately, I'm not among that population where I'm worried about that today, but I'm certainly worried about that tomorrow, and I believe that also is not a sustainable situation. So, question to either representative, if you've had an opportunity to think about that, and if you know if the legislature is prepared to take action in the event that ACA goes away.
Okay, that's a complete use of the 2 minutes.
I probably won't be able to give you an intelligent answer on that, other than I do believe that what I've been hearing is that we have our own state health care, the ACA. I don't serve in the health care committee. All I've just been hearing is they aren't too concerned at this state level right now for our citizens, but I'm sure there'll be some effect. And we'll have to just wait and see. I have no good answer for you, but I'm hearing your concerns. I hope they will not really be the result of the disabled community.
So your question was, what are we preparing in Washington State to do anything to step up to the plate for if I understand your question correctly, help our developing disabled community if the Affordable Care Act fails to do so? Correct. And I think that Representative Larry, correct me if I'm wrong, you do call each other Larry and Brad. Correct me if I'm wrong, but we are, the developmentally disabled community is one of our, in the legislature, number one concerns. We love our developmentally disabled community and citizens, and I believe, are we perfect, a perfect legislature? Absolutely, positively not. But I believe that that's paramount in our hearts and our minds. Always see everything we can protect, to help, and serve to the very best of our ability our developmentally disabled community. That's one of the things that when we talk about, everybody, you know, and they got a boss at the beginning, is the number one topic that the media and everybody wants to talk about on the media is the third. But it's not the only thing we have to consider. We cannot take up 100% of our budget. We also have other citizens, we have other needs in our state and the beginning. And we developmentally disabled community is one of the great things to do.
All right. Step forward and say your name.
My name is Michelle Levine, and I, just like the gentleman before me, also have child developmental disorders, multiple. And I am here today to represent a committee called the One Stop Committee that is working towards unified care for our Dunlop community. We are seeing in our local area that we have 2 to 3, sometimes 5 children per classroom with neurological and mental health issues. Our local numbers are way higher than national numbers. Multiple reasons I'll talk about later. We are working towards better coordination. We've seen this last week 2 situations with young men who didn't receive proper treatment. Family called for help. Police did not step in. Crisis response did not step in. Those 2 young men were both arrested when their families asked for help finding them because they had wandered away from home. They were both arrested and are both still sitting in jail. This is a situation we discovered in the last week that there is coordination issues between our services, and we're working to correct that, but we need your help. We've seen that there's laws that are in place that say this is a civil issue, this is a criminal issue, we can't cross this line, so neither one will step in. And if a 5-year-old wandered, that child would be helped. If an Alzheimer's patient wandered, that person would be helped. If you're between 12 and 55, they're not getting help. And we're seeing my own child was 11 before he finally got diagnosed. We are severely understaffed, severely short on staff, short on graduates in medical community for mental health. And we need scholarships. We need funding to emphasize and push that forward. So I'm curious what, actually I'm favored in help if you would like it, but what other support you guys already have in work for you to help that.
When you do have issues like this, anyone in this room, please bring them to our offices, bring them to our attention. This would have been a very good bill this year to help cover, try to get this covered. Most of those take 2 years, so it's always good to have a bill run first year, see it not go anywhere, find out what needs to be fixed, and move the next year into the past. So let's, you know, please take this card and for the letter. Thank you. You have to represent Clifford too. Please let us know. We're here to help.
So if I understand correctly, the issue that most concerns you is that I'm a juvenile and I'm reported to runway. Law enforcement will help get that juvenile and bring them home and interest their safety, correct? Correct?
No. So in that particular case, that the family member may call for help and ask for help finding that child.
Right.
And when they are pushed, if you've ever taken a child and you don't teach them and they try to run from you, someone who is at enough capacity and not understanding the situation is going to fight back if they're approached. That's a natural fight or flight response. And so both of these individuals, police were notified, our child is missing, they're adults. And they were told, sorry, your child's an adult, we can't help with that. Or they did go out and help look, and when they approached them, there was a panic response, and they were charged with assaulting an officer and arrested.
Okay, so the issue that you would like the legislation to fix is what specifically? I think I understand what you're saying now.
We need family advocates. We need coordination between the hospitals and the police to work together to help these individuals. Benton County is doing some great things in Benton County Jail right now, and they've developed an MPT team that is working with that. Franklin is trying, but it's not there yet.
Right. So advocates,
but we need oversight. We need somebody else to step in and adjust those laws or to, because they are saying, well, it's not a criminal issue until they touch it off.
Okay.
So we can't help.
So the last thing I want to do is Monday morning quarterback another law enforcement officer, because when we get out of this legislative session, I put my uniform on, I can go back to work as a law enforcement officer.
Right.
I wasn't there that day and that time, so I can't say why those officers did what they did or didn't do.
No, that's what they're trained to do.
But here's my defense. I have a form that I keep in what's called a posse box. Most of the law enforcement nowadays is paper. But I still keep my posse box with the form. But if you call me and say that someone is missing or a runaway, I can have you sign a form that says missing or runaway. And then that gives me the right to take them into custody in interest of their safety. Okay? Now, I don't know about if what assault took place, if an assault on an officer takes place, that is correct. It's a Class C felony. But we have, and we what we do as law enforcement officers
we try to take the person into custody with the least least force necessary to overcome the resistance. So I don't know what happened that day, but I'm more than willing, and I would love to meet with you one on one with you all, and we can help provide a solution. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Deidre Holberg. I'm a lifelong educator. I'm the mother of a student here in Hillwood Schools. I'm also married to a lifelong educator. I want to get to my prepared comments, but I also have some other comments from what I've heard today. First of all, Representative Clifford, science is real. So thank you very much for your representing one of the most scientific communities in the world is shocking. Also, freedom of speech by scolding us and telling us not to bring signs. Just because it makes you uncomfortable doesn't mean my right to have a free, open speech ends because it makes you uncomfortable. Also, thank you. Also, I've contacted your offices numerous times regarding our transgender bathroom bills that keep coming, and I have not heard back from you. I think it's a disgrace, disgusting, it's on the wrong side of history, and I would really prefer if we just did what was right, which is to let people have equal access to our public facilities at all times, period. So, just a reminder, education is our primary constitutional obligation in this state. We've been fixing that, or trying to figure that out for years and years and years, as evidenced by this packet in dribs and drabs, to the tune of now we owe to our school systems billions of dollars. So, meantime, back at the ranch, I'm just like dripping. So. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, schools are not able to fix their budgets yet. January, February, these are the times where we typically will fix our budgets for the following year. We are now in a holding pattern as we head forward into the legislative session and the end of it, and potentially a special session.
All right, ma'am, I'm going to cut you off because you've reached.
Thank you. Minute. We've had years. It's time. Make it happen. Thank you.
What was the saying that I've heard? If you want to watch legislation being made, watch, you know, watch sausage not being made. You have to like watching sausage being made. We are working on it. In fact, we voted on the levee cliff this last Thursday. I want to say Friday, Thursday, yeah, Thursday morning. We both voted yes. They had it sent out. The original levee cliff bill that was presented to us at the beginning of the session would have delayed resolving the query until a year or two away. We, as legislators, I made a promise to people in this district that I would do the best that I could to make sure that the query was resolved this year, and we'd have the package we're being worked on financed in the rest of the biennium in 2018. Legislation is slow. You've got two parties, and sometimes you have a third party. And you'll see the Democrats and Republicans getting together, not agreeing with either party. So it's a slow process, but we're going to get there. And we know we're under court order, and it will get further funded. Thank you.
Do me a favor, would you come up and take the mic and make comments or anything? If you want a response, please ask us for a response. Otherwise, I'll think you want to make a statement. So where are you at, ma'am? Who is frustrated? Do you want a response, or do you just want to make a statement?
I know, I just wanted to state.
Okay.
Again,
so I won't take up time by giving a response. I just allow you to make a statement.
All right, please state your name.
My name is Sarah Nelson. And you and I have had a chat, and you both have my letter on the transgender bathroom bill. Bathrooms are for going to the bathroom. And beyond that, oh my gosh. So I'm going to try to get my 2 minutes in. This is not my forum. I am nervous in doing this. It is very difficult for me to come forward on this stuff.
But I have to come forward on HB 1243, HB 1002, and HB 1003. Don't ask me the details of those. I did read them, but I'm not going to pull them out of my hat right now. I did write this letter, which I gave to Mr. Newhouse, and I'm happy to forward it on to you. I am a Christian. I am a medical professional, and I am pro-life. And therefore, I am against any criminalization or legislation that interferes with a woman's private life and decisions on how to handle unwanted pregnancy. Criminalization leads to more maternal deaths and does not limit abortions. It just makes them more dangerous.
Right.
Yes. We know that in the early years of this country, the government did not interfere with women's reproductive rights. We need government out of our private lives. That's a Republican principle. We can better manage the problem of unintended pregnancy by social programs supporting access to contraception, such as Planned Parenthood, that does an excellent job. And people it belongs to women. Unintended pregnancy affects all women of childbearing years, all races, all socioeconomic levels, young, middle-aged, married, and unmarried. Certainly, let's help women choose life whenever possible, but it appears that there's been a steady and growing attack in our state against women, and this attack on reproductive rights is an example. A common argument I hear...
Your 2 minutes has expired.
Okay. My question then, I'll boil it down, and one of the points here is that if you want to save babies, clean air will save babies. Because I've got a study on that, because science does matter.
Now,
why are you supporting to restrict women's rights and...
You're going to drop.
Now,
yeah.
You're
going to drop. That's a good question. Thank you. I think it's okay.
I don't think anybody's opposing
on women's rights.
Why
this attack? These multiple attacks on women's rights. And I'm speaking as a professional who treats public health. I'm an expert in this area. And I've got the science. And
so the state legislature is attacking women's rights?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Okay. So,
you got the bills right here.
All right, which bills, name the bills you want the representatives
to respond to? HB 1003, there's slow erosion.
Okay.
For instance, the one bill asks...
Ma'am, HB 1003, I guess the representatives can address those particular bills.
We hear between 2,500 and 3,000 bills a year. I have no idea what
those are. Exactly, and I'm happy to explain. The one is saying that minors have to get permission from their parents to get an abortion.
Okay, is that your question?
The
you can't give me too much about that. It's one question at a time.
You guys, you want me to get to the end of the
no,
point?
Yeah, it's one question.
The fact is that girls with good relationships will talk to their parents, and the ones that do not,
no,
are putting them in danger.
Yeah.
So the question is, why is the legislation doing these bills that are slowly eroding women's freedom to make a choice on what is best for them?
Would you like me to address that question?
Why?
Yes. Well, Mr. Taylor and Mr. Clifford, I think I know your position on this.
So would you like me not to?
You go ahead and let the public see your position.
Yes.
If I understand the question, what you just raised up, because those are three bills, three bills, you talked about one subject you specifically talked about.
You're not giving me the time to get all the way through it.
Yes, I did.
Go for it.
You want me to answer it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Okay.
Oh, wow. And she resisted.
Let him answer the question.
Okay. You talked about a child, I think you said 14 years old. I would presume that's a girl.
No.
She was pregnant.
No.
You did.
Wow, you guys are demonstrating you're having a hard time listening to white men who are privileging.
I think you were just going to make a question. Please accept the word. We're having a civil discourse here. Yes, please state your name.
My name is Laura Rathbone, and I'm with the Faith Action Network. It's my t-shirt. There is a group of progressive-minded faith communities here, and we consider ourselves Christians as well, because we care about the least of these, which means preserving the environment, health care, and so on. So that pretty much wraps up my stand on this. But I only have time probably to ask one question. And do you favor the responsible use of firearms, and if not, why? Well, I would also like to make a statement to say that I am also in support of House Bill 1646, the Clean Energy Transition Act. And rather than getting into another discussion about climate change, which I think most people in this room find really embarrassing that we even have to go there anymore, I'm shameless to say some of the most prestigious climate scientists in the world work here. So there's plenty of information available if you would take the time to get past your fear of whatever's stopping you from believing what's really happening. So if not, then at least consider looking at the bill, because it will move us to a position of creating sustainable jobs and move us away from a dying industry. So please just consider that.
Yeah.
My question is about the firearms.
You have 30 seconds left. I'll let you have those 30 seconds. But I think it's helpful this big point. We have specific questions.
I do.
That you ask them within that 30-second time limit.
I did already. I would like to know the response to what's wrong with protecting our children from shooting each other.
Okay, so you have a question there. You can begin. You say it.
Well, yes. House Bill 1122, Responsible Use of Firearms. And I believe, Larry Haley, you are on, Representative Haley, you are on the, I'm not sure which committee it's in at the moment, but you're sitting on that rules. I think there are rules.
The Rules Committee is structured such that Republicans pull Republican bills and Democrats pull Democrat bills. Now, I'm believing that that bill is one written by one of the Democrats, and it came out of committee, but it would have been in Judiciary, and I don't remember voting on it in Judiciary. So if we didn't get past Judiciary, it was the Democrat chair, Lori Jenkins, who would have been heard. So there were certain gun bills. We had 21 of them this year, and in various forms.
The assault weapon is dead.
Yes.
But I think this one, unfortunately, but I think this one is still alive and will be acted on this year.
If it has a companion bill in the Senate, and so if it died in the House, it might still be alive in the Senate. I don't know. We're two different bodies, and I hate to say it, we don't communicate until the end of the session. So it's just like two different worlds.
Would you support
responsible
use of the intent of the bill?
Well, I think that everybody who carries a firearm, which I don't, should be responsible, and for the most part are responsible. I believe that those who are gaining weapons illegally obviously do not have the best intentions.
It's not about the Second Amendment, it's about if you're going to have a gun,
let's minimize suicide and children. Thank you. My name is Joe Jensen, Sr. I'm the Washington State Chapter Chairman for the Fathers' Rights Movement. There's a lot of talk of equality here in the normal political climate of women's rights and whatnot. In Washington State, the residential time sum reports from 2000. 2008 to 2013 show custody of children awarded to mothers 80% of the time, with fathers limited to 20% of the time or less with their children. And when these orders are signed by a judge, there's often conflict that goes on during the exchanges of children. Many a times there is parental alienation or just flat out refusal of the custody orders. Washington State is primarily considered within the social circle of things as a mother state. So can you tell me why the residential crime summary report was stopped? How is this social idea that Washington is a mother state is consistent with the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause? And can you tell me why law enforcement refuses to act, saying it's a civil matter, when RCW 98.40.060 and 070 called any interference with a custody order a criminal action, both misdemeanor and felony?
Do you want to respond to that?
At both of you agree.
Okay. I ran the bill for you this year.
Thank you very much. Very welcome.
I do believe that there should be 50-50 custody unless there's some evidence that that is not a healthy environment for either the child, for the child, either because of the mother's the actions or the father's actions. I think it's 50-50. We both have the child together and should joint responsibility for raising. In our legislative structure, in our committee structures, and give you a little civics lesson here if you don't mind, the chair has all power. And my chairman, Laura Jenkins, of the judiciary, said she did not feel that fathers had rights. So, in these kind of cases, the mother was the better parent. Now, word for word, basically. And so she said, I'm killing the bill. So that's, other than getting a different chairman, as long as the Democrats are, maybe the other party is in charge, you will have that kind of, some of those individuals. Lori's a great lady. It's just her point of view. Thank you.
Can you explain how the Washington State philosophy that this is a mother state is constitutionally accurate within the Equal Protection Clause? Question.
So, in fact, what you say about Washington being a mother state is it a statute? It's not a statute, right?
But the statistics show.
Exactly, and I agree with you. You're correct. The statistics show that. And I don't know why that is. It's the judge, like you said, the judgment of the court. Nothing that's coming down from legislation. So it's not from us. Okay, we delegate the authority to the court to make the judgment of the mom and the dad of the court. You decide. So why that happens, I apologize to you. I do not know.
And then my other question, and you'd probably be more likely to answer this, that when orders are not followed and the police officers are called, they say it's a civil matter when there's a law on the books that says any interference with a court order for residential crime is criminal. Yet the police will not enforce those orders or enforce that criminal statute, which creates a liability for the state because they're aiding and abetting in the commission of crime.
Understood. So my law enforcement brothers are here tomorrow, which they were, so they could correct me if they felt that I'm wrong. But here's what's told by our civil divisions, because in law enforcement we have criminal, we have civil law. Our civil division tells us when, say, for instance, your former spouse, correct? Would that be?
Yes.
Well, let's say that this beautiful lady and I were once married, and we have children in common, okay? And right now, the children are supposed to be with me for the weekend, and she didn't give them up. So that's custodial interference. She should, that's on the different court order. And you call me and say, wait a second, she didn't obey by the court order. That's custodial interference. What our civil divisions have told us, do not place your hands on that child without a writ of habeas corpus from a judge who says, you shall take those child into custody so the court can decide what's gone on. And that's just the truth of the matter of how it operates in the law.
then I would offer a rebuttal.
Go ahead, you use the mic directly. I'd love to hear what you say.
I would offer a rebuttal. As legislators, perhaps you should change the law so a crime is not being ignored. If that's the intent of the law of the law enforcement communities, which are subservient to the legislature, how are we in the law enforcement community being subservient to the legislature, telling the legislature that their laws that they passed don't apply?
So if you would please, if the bill that they're responsible for this year doesn't get to part of that matter, please get together with either one of us, and I'd love to work with you, and let's get something drafted that addresses that issue that you're talking about, okay?
Very well.
Thank you.
All right, let's hold our pause for the next gentleman. Please state your name and your question.
My name is Dennis Walters. I have recently been looking into the condition of electromagnetic pulse and its impact on the electrical infrastructure in the United States. This information is not new. It was a very detailed study done back in 2007 and more recently, I think, in 2015. 10 years ago, this was sort of an unreasonable event because you have to have a delivery vehicle and a nuclear weapon. As we all know from watching the recent events in Iran and also in North Korea, there are a number of rogue states, and there's also some serious potential loss of technology that could result in a detonation. Now, about 2 years ago, I heard a newscast that said, oh, look, the Iranians are not being successful. They had to destroy their rocket at Apogee. Well, Apogee is the place you detonate a nuclear warhead to get the maximum impact on electromagnetic pulse. In the event of an electromagnetic pulse, we would lose all communications. We would lose all cellular, everything electronic in the United States within the affected area.
Which, 30 seconds.
Thank you. So if we had this going on, we would have a major existential threat to the people of the state of Washington and the nation as a whole. I wanted to find out what was going on right now, and I think probably Representative Clifford, you have probably a very good background for this. What is being done for emergency response capability and to deal with this potential existential threat to the people of the state of Washington?
So the threat that you spoke of, you mentioned Russia and other nations, correct?
It could be other nations as well, yes. It's an attack by a hostile, by any hostile force that has the capability to deliver the weapon.
And I think you're specifically referring to the effect of electromagnetic pulse.
Correct. It's electromagnetic pulse.
So, as you may understand, the majority of your question has to do with what the federal government is doing about national security. True or false?
No.
My question deals with the protection of the infrastructure against the effects of electromagnetic pulse. The state of Washington has utility commissions. It has some power production capabilities. What are we doing to protect what we can in absence of federal action?
Yeah. So here's the best way I know to respond to your question. One, PNNL is working specifically on those issues. The protections they're working on are the power grid and protection thereof. And then another answer to your question, the Washington Military Department, both the National Guard and the Washington State Guard, I'm the commander of the State Guard, like we have one of the top security people from Microsoft serves with me in uniform. And it's called a cybersecurity unit, but that is what they're looking at, the effects of all of that on our technological infrastructure. So that's what I would say that we are doing to protect us against such a threat.
Are we doing anything with actual hardening of any physical hardware in the state, either through Longville Power or other licensed entities, to protect the large equipment that's going to take 18 months to replace
yes, when I toured their facilities, it's worked beyond those areas that they mentioned, probably will have, And then our cybersecurity team is also working with the Vista and other corporations to help them prepare their infrastructure to harden itself against such a attack.
Next question, please. Take your name and
I'm Karen Lipp, and I'm a kindergarten teacher here in Richland School District. And representative Taylor and Clifford, I wanted to share with you and appeal to you about House Bill 610 and the voucher system and charter schools. I taught in California. This is my 30th year. I was there 7 years in a school of 98% free and reduced lunch. Poverty school. I came here because I had a heart for the kids in our community here that were students of poverty. And our district has been doing a lot of research. The children that we need to make the biggest difference for are our students of poverty. They're the ones we need to reach. We've been bringing in authors of books for high performing that wrote a book about the high performing schools that have reached their students of poverty. And at very high levels, we've set goals, and we're already seeing a difference from goals just that this year at our high school, doing different and innovative things. We can't reach our kids of poverty unless they've had breakfast, unless we have the special services to help them, and we have the support to reach kids who come with a myriad of challenges to their education. And so, you know, we all went through the public school, many of us went through the public school.
30 seconds.
Put men on the moon. And I think now our academic standards are so much higher. And we are reaching those standards. And I just wanted to ask you, how can we do it if we don't have full funding? The funding we have right now, our principal and vice principal ride the bus home with students of poverty and get to know their families. And we read to them in the summer. We take books to their homes. We feed them. We clothe them. We're meeting their needs physically so that they can learn.
And we have a specific question.
How can we reach the students in poverty? Do you think we're doing a good job? And if not, how can we reach these kids if we don't have funding? Let's say we take away 25% of the funding. How can we do it?
It's our sincere hope as legislators in both bodies to make sure that those monies that were taken away from education during the last 30 years put into social services are then now put back into education. There's a direct correlation to the problems that we have today in our schools to a time frame where about 30 years ago, before McClary was the candidate, where the late Senator Andy Hill grabbed that he could show that as time went on, the monies that were in education were actually stripped out of there and put into social services. So what I say to you and the people here today, everybody, is that our ultimate social service is education. We need to get those monies out of the social services and back into education in some form or another to make sure that children of poverty and all of our children get the same kind of education that we can take them in the schools. But unfortunately, we're dealing with the reality of trying to take money from, because that's the only place we're going to get money without raising taxes, is getting money from those social services. And they're this year asking for 8 new departments in social service, which will take more money out of someplace if those go through. We don't need that many more departments. In fact, we need 8 new departments. But they just understand the plan goes on. And I see that in appropriations. I know that because it's in appropriations.
I appreciate, we're trying to have a civil discourse here. The important thing about democracy is that we respect the
the respect the speakers in time, so I don't want to have any negative comments from either political philosophy today, all right? So next question, please.
My name is Nathan Berry, and I'm very much in favor of the capital gains tax, which would help this lady get the money that she needs to support her schools. As you know, we have a very regressive tax structure in the state. People making $20,000 pay seven times as much in terms of ratio, a share of their income that people say a couple hundred thousand pay. And in this climate of increasing income inequality, it only makes sense to have a capital gains tax, which would help support education. This tax that being, we're only one of nine states that does not have a capital gains tax. So, and this one is 7.9%. It's less than the Oregon capital gains tax. It's less than California capital gains tax. So I'd like to have your response on whether you support the capital gains tax, and if not, I'd like to know why.
So, in interest, so that everybody understands, let's describe, what is, give me an example, what is a capital gains tax? What capital gains would we be taxed? Give me just an example.
I really don't have that information here, but it would not include IRAs, it would not include farm income, so it would just include probably the top 1% that are doing trades, you know, regular trades in the stock market and the capital gains that they make from those trades.
Okay, interesting. So, you understand your correctly. If 1928 was it, we had a stock market crash that sent the nation into the Great Depression. Okay, so the stock market's kind of important in this nation. Right? So we want the stock market to be successful because that stock market helps businesses produce goods and jobs keep going. So what you're saying is when people invest in the stock market so they can make money in the stock market, help the stock market keep going, they should have a tax because that's unfair to other people who are making less money who don't have capital.
No, what I'm saying, sir, is that they are the ones that are benefiting the most in this kind of economy. That's why we're seeing this income gap, this big income inequality gap that we're seeing. And since the people at the bottom are paying a greater percent, it only makes sense that these people should pay their fair share. And like I say, it's only like the top 1%.
So, I don't want to take 30, you asked me to talk to Muslims, I don't want to take too much of this time, so I got to give you some time. It's not my first choice, a capital gains tax. Right now, the four corners, House Republicans, House Democrats, Senate Republicans, Senate Democrats, and then the fifth quarter is the governor's office, are working together in negotiations to find a funding mechanism for McCleary and our state budget. Capital gains tax would not be one of my first choices. If those four quarters, those five quarters come together and say to me, Brad, that's the only solution we can come up with. That's the only solution we can come up with to balance this budget and fully fund education. If they tell me that, I will probably, from my leaders who are responsible for those negotiations, I will probably vote with them. But I'm telling you right now, I do not want to penalize the people in this country who work hard money, because that's what makes America apparently good. There's nothing wrong with the power of the heart in America. That's me.
Yeah. Thank you.
You heard from the point.
I wish I was one of those people in the negotiations, but I'm not. I do serve on appropriations, and we have to rely on our leadership to work with the governor, again, to be a bipartisan solution this year. So there is a capital gains tax in there, and Brad, I will have to support that, because we can't limp along on behalf of education, and we've got to get that funded. That's the number one priority. That's the only thing that's required of us in our state constitution. So if it's in there, yes, I'll vote for it. I'm not really too hot on taxing one segment or the other too heavily. I think that a lot of the taxes we see today are the result of a broken national tax system. And I think that they need to fix their tax system, and maybe we can follow suit. I think it rests with them to come up with a solution. And right now, I think that all of us are taxed too much, no matter whether we get capital gains tax or not. I do think that those who have, this is probably going to get some booze, but those who have invested wisely and have put their monies, and they need to pull those monies out for one reason or another, they shouldn't be inordinately taxed. So capital gains tax is kind of getting on the fringe of where I can't go. But if it's part of the package, as Representative Icker has said, I will vote for that package.
I'd like to thank you for voting and supporting 1783, the LFO bill.
You're very welcome. That's been a big bill for Representative Holt from Spokane. That's his bill, and you should get all the credit. That was a great, very good bill. All right. Next person, please state your name and your question.
My name is Deborah Meyer, and I live in Washington, Oregon, for about 40 years. And this is for the bill H2631. Do you think this is a true interpretation of separation of church and state? It's your bill for letting people discriminate against people because of their religion.
Trust me, that bill does not say that. It
said, okay, so business legal rights to choose whether to provide services at a same-sex marriage based on their conscious religious beliefs or philosophical tendencies.
So you're asking, did I sponsor that bill?
Yeah.
So you're asking, do I support that?
No, I'm asking you if you think that's a true representation of the separation of church and state.
Okay. When I swore to took an oath for this office, I swore to uphold the Constitution of Washington State and the United States. Okay? Mm-hmm. So let's just go to what the Constitution says, because I use the Constitution to be my God. Mm-hmm. First Amendment, the very first part of the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment or of religion or prohibit the free exercise thereof. That's the very first half of the very First Amendment. Okay? Now let's see what Washington State has to say about the same subject. Washington State Constitution, religious freedom. Absolute freedom of conscience in all matters of religious sentiment, belief, and worship shall be guaranteed to every individual, and no one shall be molested or disturbed in person or property on account of religion. So you are absolutely correct in your question, or I would say affirmatively, absolutely yes. If I'm a business owner and I say that I do not want to participate with my business in a same-sex marriage, but with my belief according to the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of Washington, I absolutely, positively have guaranteed constitutional right not to do that.
I believe that people have the right to tell people that they don't want it. But I think there should be like a truth in advertising which has a big sign that says, gay is not welcome. This is the beginning of a slippery slope when you allow religious laws.
Here's the deal. Are you talking about Baroness Sutton and Harley Flowers?
Yes.
Okay, so here we go. I was in the courtroom when this was the final judgment was made in this court here in the Tri-City, and I was in the hearing for the Washington State Supreme Court on this issue. Okay? Baroness Sutton, when they came and asked her to supply the flowers for their wedding, she said, "I can't do your wedding." That was her direct quote. "I can't do your wedding." Baroness Sutton served them as customers many years before that and will serve them as customers many years after that. She's more than glad to sell them flowers. She does not want to participate in that activity.
I understand.
It's not the gays aren't welcome there. Gays are welcome there. She knew they were gays and served them for many years and will still serve them today. She doesn't want to participate in that particular event. Not the people, the event.
Okay.
She loves the people. It's not a people issue.
Does it stop here? And just this one religious law Or do we keep, now we're going to have, let keep other people choose what they're going to do according to their religion?
That's the Constitution, that you're right, yes.
And that means no matter what, there's religions that believe black people have the right to live. I mean, where does the religious law stop?
Black people do have a right to live.
Yes, they do, but there are religions that don't believe that.
Okay. Anyway.
I think that the time has expired. I think that the questioner expressed her opinion. Please state your name and your question, please.
Yes, my name is Sarah Murphy, and I would like to ask both representatives, what is your stand on Senate Bill 5008? And I know you mentioned earlier that you see thousands of bills, so read the the brief summary of the bill. It requires the Department of Licensing DOL to mark standard issued driver's license and identification cards as not complying with the Real ID Act beginning July 1st, 2018. The second bullet is it lowers the fees for enhanced driver's license and for $9 for the next 4 years. So my question to both of you is, where do you stand on this bill? And I also have another question separate from this, which is as far as L&I insurance. I volunteer in the community and I see a lot of people that have claims with L&I. And so my question as far as the L&I goes, I would like to know, how can we hold L&I accountable and how can we be clear on their procedures? I believe that the workers, they pay their dues to L&I and they deserve medical attention.
I can answer the question about Real ID. We're one of the last states, there's only two states that have not adopted the Real ID Act.
And what we're, there's five states.
Fine, okay, I was told to. I still work at the Hanford site, at least did as of the beginning of this meeting. I don't know what I'm doing. But I still work up there as a tour guide, and we cannot take people who come from Washington State along the River Road by the Pike Bluffs, old town of Pike Bluffs at Hanford, because we do not have a Real ID Act. We also, if you are a Washington State resident and you don't have a Real ID Act on your driver's license, you cannot visit a military base. That is.
I thought it's not an act till January 2018.
They're trying to get all of us in the United States to comply with this, that if we do not, as a state, from my understanding, if we do not adopt this Real ID Act by 2018, we as citizens of this state can't visit our families and military bases. We can't visit the Hanford site. It's going to be a real crackdown. And so the Real ID is extremely important for all of us as citizens. And you can't get it in passport. So
when you say you can't visit, I mean, I think that's a false statement because you should be able, I mean, there's alternative IDs that you could use.
There is
so
alternative.
Then you should be able to visit using the alternative.
Yeah, okay.
But they may not honor that alternative ID if 2018.
Passport is the
only thing. Yeah, the passport is the only thing that's valid, and if you can't get a passport because of the Real ID, that kind of negates the situation.
How will you not be able to get a passport? I mean, if you have a birth certificate, you meet the regulations that the
I mean, I'm in an area that I'm not familiar with. All I'm dealing with is what I was told as a Hanford worker. I can't take people out from the Hanford site after a certain period of time if we don't have the Real ID on our license.
Unless they
meet
the alternative.
You can't get the passport without that. But We as a state want to get the Real ID Act passed so we don't have to put our citizens through a lot of the other things we have to go through.
Our delivery drivers can't show up at the site.
Okay, I think that issue's been addressed, and I will
move on to the next question.
I asked both of the representatives.
Very quickly. I mean, because we got a half hour left, and how many people still have a question? Please raise your hand. Enlighten them. So we got a half.
I mean, if you can take a half a minute and just answer what your stand on it.
Okay. 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 So you're asking, let me see if I can burn it down to that 30 seconds you're talking about. Are you asking me if I'm saying that you need to be a legal resident to get a license? To get a
no, that's not what I'm asking.
So then I have not read that bill because the bill is just now making their way over the house, and I don't know the specifics of that bill.
Everybody went to transportation.
I'm not on transportation. You need that. That's a Senate bill. I'm in the house. They just came over. The cutoff was Wednesday at 5 o'clock. I haven't read that bill yet. So I can't tell you that,
you know, as you guys are representing our districts, and you guys are very misinformed, just so sad.
Next person, please state your name and your question.
President Lofton, first I want to thank Larry real quick for helping me pass the bill to bring awareness to the Washington public about the detriment of parental abduction to the children. I truly appreciate it. We're here because we are supporting the movie industry competitive bill. Mr. Clifford, you may know I just shot a short film with your daughter Alexis, and we had a great time doing that. We actually won the competition here locally.
She's here today.
Yeah, I saw her in the corner. She did a great job too as well. But the bill, the stats I've seen on the bill, you're only providing $3.5 million. I think that if we don't renew it, it goes to zero. They may not even, I don't think they're even looking to increase it. But I have seen stats that say that we're bringing in $10 for every dollar spent. And I don't know what other industry can bring in that kind of return. Anyway, so we have the Tri-City International Film Festival here also. And we wanted to go to Olympia, because there's a formal meeting for this on Monday. But we weren't able to make it. So we just want to leave this check with you guys. Hopefully you'll support it and bring more movie industry here into Washington State. It was about 5 years ago, Louisiana had a lot more support for film industry. They were doing great. I think they've dropped it since. And it's gone down a bit there. But I just want you to know that there are people here in your area that support this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next person. Please state your name and your question, please.
Hi, my name is Kate Moran. And first, I would just like to comment to Representative Haler. I would just like to say that, and I'm going to get the exact wording. We really appreciate your efforts on behalf of the Hanford workers. I work out there at the VIT plant, and I have a lot of friends that work in Hanford. We're really looking forward to work with you in the future. And something that I think that Representative Clifford forgot to mention was in page 2, section 2B, it says, for those presumptions that the occupational disease may be refuted and cleared and by clear and convincing evidence. So it's not everything is covered. It's if there's refuting evidence saying that it isn't something from Hanford, it's not going to be covered. But thank you very much for passing that, Representative Hammond. I really appreciate your support. And actually, what I'm here for is I would like to talk to you regarding HJM 4003. I'm asking for both of your support for that. 90% of Americans want. Oh yeah, it's specifically asking for an Article 5 Convention of States specifically regarding campaign finance reform. 90% of Americans want campaign finance reforms and are concerned about corrupting influence in corporate, union, special interests, and wealthy individuals. I want a government that represents us, and not just those that can afford to spend excessively on our elections. An Article 5 Convention of the States to write amendment, which is what this bill calls for, would not open up the Constitution. That's a popular misconception, and 75% of the states must agree to ratify or approve, so it must be popular and nonpartisan. This bill specifically requests for a convention only for the purpose of discussing this issue of campaign finance reform. The passage of I-735 indicates that Washington state voters have given the green light to write an amendment, and that Congress is not going to do it, or they would have by now. We trust our state legislators to make this convention happen. We both support H.
JM4003 regarding the Article 5 Convention of States.
Nice.
I was looking it up here, and it is still on the docket, and I think that if we can get a majority votes, yeah, we'll vote for it. Right now, it doesn't appear, it hasn't moved, and there's a Senate Joint Memorial of 8,000 Muslims, companion memorial, so it hasn't moved yet. It had the Speaker of the House is on these joint memorials is the final resolver or the final person, the gatekeeper. So he is one of the minority leader of the ones that allow these to come out. So we have not seen it yet, but I'll ask for it.
Thank you. I feel that it's a nonpartisan issue, so I think that it's something that everybody on all sides of the aisle can agree with regarding campaign finance.
Ma'am, yes, ma'am.
Yes.
Will I support that?
Yes.
Well, I'll just say it like this. 2 minutes left, well, 30 seconds left. There was a rally on the steps of the Capitol for this issue, and I was the only legislator on the steps there to hear and to listen to what was said. There were some great speakers. I'm still listening. I've had people in my office. We've talked about this on multiple occasions. Like Larry says, it has to come up for a vote. I don't anticipate it's going to come up for a vote. The only thing I disagree on with you on is I do believe it will open the Constitution, and that is my fear.
Thank you. All right, next person, please state your name and your question.
My name is Sarah Flores Anderson. First of all, I'd like to thank both of you for actually coming and meeting us face to face.
Yes.
Mr. Hale, I really appreciate that you supported the roads bill last year that's going to do all the work out in Richland and blah, blah, blah. That's huge for our community. I really appreciate that. But my two questions actually have to do with two kind of different things. The first question is that the Freedom Foundation is an organization that keeps running through the Republican Party trying to break up workers' rights and trying to break up our ability to negotiate fairly for contracts. I just want to know what your positions are on that, and are you hearing a lot? Because I know that there are 7 bills coming out of the Senate that deal with workers' rights, and those are all put forward by the Freedom Foundation. So are you supporting that? As Republicans, they seem to be coming through the Republican Party, and I don't understand how a Republican Party that's supposed to support the workers keeps trying to erode worker rights.
It is our constitutional right at the state level and at the federal level to assemble as we choose, and unions are part of those rights. And I was a former union steward on the Asia for a union after, so did that for 7 years. So I do believe that it is our right. If you and I and Mr. Bilson's decided we want to form a union right now, so Democrats and Republicans or whatever, people in the middle or whatever, we have that right to do that. The government can't tell us not to do it because it was a guaranteed civil right, and it's been proven that in courts also. So I do support unions as well as I support people who don't work in unions, but I've been my ears are always open to the unions. I know your issues, I've been in your feet, or shoes, I should say. In fact, I let a strike one time. So, yes, I understand your issues, and I do appreciate our unions.
Your question directly, let me see if I'm going on the right word.
Yes, I'm very concerned. Because it's really a right to work for less money. Because if we can't negotiate with our employers, can't negotiate for better benefits, can't negotiate for correct, healthy workplaces, those kind of things, that becomes an issue. And that keeps coming through the Freedom Foundation, and they seem to be working their way through the Republican Party. So I just want to know where you stand on those issues.
Okay. So I, like Larry, have been a member of many unions, Laborers Union, the
what was that? I'm trying to remember. Millwright's, and I've also been a vendor. When I was at the Jailers and the Teamsters, when I was in law enforcement, I first said there as a deal. We got out of the Teamsters and formed our own guild. So now I'm a member of the guild. So I support your the right to have unions, but I'll just give you the same answer I gave that I gave everybody else. Doesn't matter who it is in this room, there's a job open out there. If you're the most qualified, the best educated person, and the employer picks you, you should be able to get that job, no matter your union affiliation or not. If you're the best qualified, the most experienced person to get the job, then you should be able to get the job. Because you have got the education, you've got the experience, you've got what the employer needs. That's between you and the employer. Now, if you are at that a union shop or a union job, I ask you by law, you can have that job and not be required by law to make payments to union, but those payments can go to something else.
I guess my concern is more from the legislative side. As these bills keep coming down, are you supporting those bills then that erode our worker rights? Or are you standing on the side of the workers and saying, no, we're not going to keep eroding our rights?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you what we're done. And I'm gonna, you're not going to get a direct answer to my question. I support the person who's got the education, got the experience, is most able to do the job. So that employer can hire that person. And then, under current law, whether you pay union dues or your money goes to something else, that you are not lawfully required to pay to the union.
So I'm just understanding that you're saying
I am not part of the Freedom Foundation, I'll tell you that.
But you're not necessarily going to continue to support worker rights to associate.
I just like I think Larry said to you, I support everyone's right. Everyone has a right to work in this
country. Okay, I got you. So my second question has to do with education. And I know I've spoken about this to you before, that part of our, a huge portion of our money, and I think I asked you the last time I was in the town, while we talked to you gentlemen, that you were supposed to maybe bring us numbers that actually showed how much the state testing, the national testing we have to do, actually takes away from our budget, and I haven't yet seen that. But my concern, and I know neither of you is actually on the education thing, committees, but we would really like some feedback from you about how the delinking of those tests from our graduation requirements is going, because I'm not hearing a lot. I keep hearing rumors that maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't happen. And where do you stand on delinking?
Can I ask you a question real quick to run out that?
Okay, so we're
out of time. The House and ask is moving forward, and I think we both support that. Am I correct?
Yes, I support the delinking, and it's moving it moved through the House and headed to the Senate. So it's this isn't Europe, this is America. And our students are not faring well under the European testing system or the Japanese testing system. And we need to get back to being Americans, Washingtonians, and get an education system turned around.
Next question, please. Sir, please state your name and your question.
Hi, my name's Kelly McBride. I'm with Washington. My wife and I are that McBride. We are adult family homeowners for 21 years now. I've provided handouts for Representative Flipper and Haler. I have two questions that won't take long. The first one is based on the fact that we're getting more and more elderly getting in the long-term care system. This is increasing the demand for Medicaid services in adult family homes. 57% of adult family home beds are currently occupied by Medicaid clients. This improves access to care for clients living with developmental disabilities and mental health needs. My first question is, will you representatives review Senate 511-8 and 1139? Oh, excuse me, House Bill 1139, 1763, and vote for those if you agree. The other one is House Bill 2027, which has to do with adult family home inspections with neighbors. Right now, the Administrative Code 388-76 addresses the requirement for an adult family home to abide by all local laws and ordinances and remain home-like in nature. DSHS, the reasons for recommending you go against this, DSHS does not have the authority to regulate neighborhood concerns, potential violation of residents' privacy. Statute already requires compliance. There's an 800 number. Anyone can call if they have a problem with an adult family home, and increased funding would be required. So we ask if you agree with these to please vote, if this, please vote against it. Thank you so very much for all your good service. And your doors, I've worked with you over the years. Your doors have always been open. You are great representatives. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hate to say that. If you could give us the title, that gives us more an idea of what you're talking about, because if I was to try to memorize all the titles, the same representative, the other representatives, we wouldn't have a session for a few years, because it's we have 4,000 bills. Keep in mind that only 200, 300 at the most become law.
And in answer to your question, yes, if that bill comes up, I will absolutely positively review it to see if I cannot, yes, or yes, or you ask to oppose the other. Yes, we will review it to before us. Okay, we just got 12 minutes left. I'd like everyone who has a question to be able to ask a chance to ask a question, so I'll try to make a brief answer.
My name is Jennifer Soltis, and I'm a Richmond resident. So I understand how budgets work. You have to have money coming from somewhere to be able to pay for the things you want to do. But I heard a couple of things, this may not be what you meant, but I heard a couple of things when we were talking about the capital gains tax. So the capital gains tax, that's money that gets taxed, for instance, if you buy your house and it quadruples in value, and you sell your house later. So $20,000, that's a really low home value, right? But okay, and you sell it for $80,000. You could be taxed potentially up on that $60,000 net gain. That's actually, there's limits, so because that's under $250,000, you wouldn't be taxed on that money. But my point is, the capital gains tax really only affects people who are very, very wealthy. And one of the statements that I heard was, those people have worked hard for their money. And I don't disagree with that. But the other part that I heard in that was, the rest of us don't work hard enough for our money.
Yeah.
And that we have low wages for our work simply because we don't work hard enough. So that money for the budget has to come from somewhere. And maybe it can come from the people who make 20 times more than I do.
Anybody that sells a house or sells stocks, we pay the ultimate capital gains tax when we have to file with the federal government and pay taxes then. So we are getting out without, we're not getting away without paying taxes in some form or another. The ultimate is the federal government taking that money. So I'd rather have it taken at the local level, but I think that capital gains really has to be an issue that's worked out more than just one legislative session. We need to have some sort of working committee. We haven't done that yet. All right, next speaker. Please state your name and ask your question.
Hello, gentlemen. My name is Crystal Gonzalez. I'm from California and here 2 years ago. So I would just like to, I get to say shame on you, sir. Climate change is real. We've been in a 10-year drought in California. We've had water restrictions. People had to limit their shower time. You know, they were encouraged to not garden. You know, there were all these things. Climate change is real. You know, and in one season, we're like almost out of the drought. Like, that's not normal. You know, like, give me a break here. We're flooding over there. So all sorts of things. Climate change is real, and that's that. But I came out here because the transgender issue has been raised, and I feel like there's been no answer to that. My issue is, you know, there are transgenders that look like me, that, you know, that are, they don't have the sex change, and they identify, they're born male, identify as a female. Would you feel comfortable a person like me walking into the urinal next to you and, you know, using the restroom? Do you think that's going to make someone feel uncomfortable, possibly the person next to you? I mean, why can't they use the restroom that they identify with? And do you think that it's making us, or that it's making the transgender community safer because these people are going to be using the restroom that they were born with? I mean, I can see, you know, plenty of moms seeing a male or seeing a female or seeing a male going in there as a female, you know, having sorts of issues and concerns. I can see females going into male stalls, you know, being harassed or, you know, abused or just having, you know, being assaulted possibly. Is that making them safe? Don't you care about them? Aren't we Americans? That shouldn't we all be treated equally? I don't understand how you guys can go back on the bill that's already passed. Why are you guys doing that, and why don't you want to protect the transgender? I mean, are we giving them less taxes, you know? Like, we're corrupting them the same. Shouldn't they be treated the same and given the access to where they feel comfortable to use the restroom? They're just going to the bathroom. They're not trying to, you know. I mean, I feel less comfortable sending my 10-year-old into the men's restroom. You know why? Because men are pedophiles. I'm trying to have the priest, you know? What then? So that's my issue. That's my concern. I'd like it to be addressed. Thank you.
You have a specific question?
So do you think it's making transgender people safe? Is it making Americans safe to use a restroom that they don't identify with?
Okay, can I answer your question? You ready?
Yes.
No. Less than 30 seconds.
Yep.
It's right back there. This facility happens to belong to the Archdiocese of Detroit City. If they chose to put a female bathroom, a male bathroom, and a bathroom that is neutral for anyone to use, I totally support their right to do that. Okay?
Okay.
So they can do that, but that costs money. I'm not going to tell them by state law that they have to do that, okay? No, you cannot have the mic back because there's people behind you. We have less than 10 minutes left. So I'm going to tell you this.
I got mic too.
I do not.
Give it up.
What? That's my wonderful daughter's name back there, okay? I do not want a male going into her shower room because that's what the bill, that's what the law currently says.
A male looks like
me. Ma'am, you're interrupting me. You asked me for a response. I don't want her going into her shower room and disrobing her or seeing her disrobe in her shower, because that says that that can happen now, and I do not now support that, nor will I ever support it.
We have about 8 minutes left, so I'm going to basically, there are 1, 2, 3, 4 people in line, and Lloyd, I saw you speak in there.
I'm only going to make comments. I'm not going to ask any questions.
All right. I'm going to ask a question. You got 1 minute each. We're going to try and get through the next 4 people in the next 8 minutes. Thank you.
Hi, this has to do with the state income tax proposed. My name is Ron Higgins, lives in Washington. I was running for state of Point office. I went to Seattle, met a gal, very nice young lady from the country of Somalia. She was a nurse, a very personal individual, and she had moved from Somalia to California. Then she moved up from California, she escaped California, and moved up to Washington State. So I asked, why did you move up to Washington State? And she moved up to Washington State because we don't have a state income tax. This gives us a tremendous advantage over other states. Please do not succumb to all the moochers who went to pick somebody else's pocket with a state income tax. Please stand against the state income tax, a capital gains tax, and stand against the carbon tax. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I actually don't have a question, just a statement. So my name is Ray Geimer. I'm the president of Modern Living Services, a local charitable organization that does services strictly for the intellectual and developmental disability community. One thing I'd like to tell you, a little story. My wife and I and son were at a restaurant. We were waited on by a very nice young lady who had a 4-year-old with a very debilitating genetic disease, who was thankful for the infant and toddler program, but now was wondering, what do I do now? So I encourage you to look at programs that bridge the gap between infant and toddler, which ends at 3, and school, which actually starts at 5. We had a program for my son in New York. It was a full-time, year-round program, and it was an awesome program, and it helped him immensely. So second thing that I would like to address is adult family homes. One objectives. We're going to go build six adult family homes. HB 1383, concerning the number of adult family homes permitted in residential neighborhoods, would limit that to two. And that's a shame.
Please state your name, your question, or statement. You have 1 minute.
I'm Nancy Barr, raised in Redwood City, had a chance to go to Seattle, and came back to Richmond. What I would like to see, since my eyes are wide open, is what can we do for the vets? We have Hanford out here, and we have to go all the way to Walla Walla, or Spokane, or Seattle. And on that note also, I have an autistic grandson. I have to go to Seattle to get help. So can we bring services down here? We've got the space.
So I was at the grand opening of the new veterans facility in Walla Walla a couple weekends ago. Getting my beautiful daughter back there, but not very much, but it was a great time. My understanding is there's a clinic down by Cabot, the veterans can go through that through.
Yes, that's true, sir.
So,
what other services are veterans not being here that you want?
I have to take my husband down to Walla Walla to get a colonoscopy when I'm right there.
So colonoscopy services here.
Blood services, x-rays, everything.
I Walla Walla.
Walla Walla.
That would be a big one.
All right. Okay. I would suggest that you discuss that issue. I think that the Veterans Administration is a federal issue, but I am certain that your representative can work very hard to represent the people in this community. You'd be more than glad to discuss that with our federal representative. Because that should be part of some sort of benefit form. So we'll have to take the next question because we're running out of time.
And what about the autistic? We need more
services. There's more man who needs services. He's getting pro bono services from the retired counselor right now. She asked Brad to get services for the particular need for this person, 7-year-old boy. And so I worked with DSHS, and now I've got another person, Department of Commerce, and I'm trying to help find the money to get those services here because it's very convoluted. And that's right. If we can talk offline about it.
Thank you.
All right, next person. 1 minute, please state your name and your statement or question.
Michelle Gerber, Richmond. I'm here for the second time to talk about sentencing reform. As you know, there is a drug epidemic going on. The CDC says that, the University of Washington, the National Institute of Drug Abuse, all agree there is a drug epidemic. A lot of people, especially young people, make a mistake. They try drugs, they get caught, and they get a conviction. Then they turn their life around, but they still have that conviction that is hindering their life. It prevents them from renting, from getting jobs, other things. I wonder if you would support or introduce a bill that would call for sentencing reform so that the possession of a small amount of drugs with no violence, no weapons, would be a misdemeanor instead of felony. We also have a provision for people that has already happened to have a retroactive way to go back and get their conviction reduced. Thank you.
All right, perfect time.
For both. Would you support that?
Support it. Okay, so there right now there was a bill that came out of the Public Safety Committee already mentioned top of it. It is a study bill to study sentencing reform. So that's been done moving through the House. Now I don't know if it moved on before. I don't think it did. It came out of committee. Okay, so there's that. And then your other question was
The retroactive provision so that if it's already happened to
the drug. We can pin on the drugs. Okay, so if it's a very harmful and dangerous drug they're in possession of, I'm not going to reduce the drug.
Thank you. All right. We are reaching time, but Mr. Becker, you've been patient. I will give you 1 minute to make a statement, but I can't promise you a good answer.
I'm not even looking for an answer. I've been listening to everybody. Let me try and make me a short closeout statement. Number one, we've been talking about Hanford. I worked out in Hanford. I gave him an idea how to put the 100 area, 2 west, and part of 2 east in the ground in 10 years. And no, it's not how it works. We do a little bit today, so our grandchildren got something to do tomorrow. And so that's how that works. Now, I've been hearing a lot of things, and and abortions is one of them. Well, needless to say, I'm going to say it this way. When you separate women's health away from Planned Parenthood, then I can agree with the state about women's health. But when is baby's health important?
I see.
And so, anyway, I just want to bring up the Hanford thing, and since the HAB has been installed, I have a pay in the...
Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude our section. I know some of the people in this room, and I don't know others, but I want to thank everybody for being here. This is an important part of what makes America great, the civic engagement with your representatives. When you don't come to these events, and if you don't ask questions, you know, we start our democracy to grow. This is an important part of the democratic process. I appreciate it. And Representative Taylor, Representative Cook.
But I know that the both of us thank you for taking 2 hours or more of your time to come and listen to you as a part of this. I know that my door is open to everybody. Crazy because everybody comes into my office.